now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
For over two decades, the identity of Melissa Witt's murderer has been hidden among the dense trees and thorny undergrowth, rooted deeply in the uneven ground of a remote mountaintop in the Ozark National Forest. Determined to find answers, LaDonna Humphrey has spent the last 7 years hunting for Melissa's killer. Her investigation, both thrilling and unpredictable, has led her on a journey like no other. The Girl I Never Knew is an edge-of-your-seat account of LaDonna Humphrey's passionate fight for justice in the decades-old murder case of a girl she never met in person. Her unstoppable quest for the truth has gained the attention of some incredibly dangerous people, some of whom would like to keep Melissa's murder a mystery forever. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Girl I Never Knew, Who Killed Melissa Witt, with my special guest, journalist and author, LaDonna Humphrey. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, LaDonna Humphrey.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Also, forgot to mention that you are also a documentary producer and filmmaker. So we will be talking about that in this interview as well, obviously.
Fantastic.
Let's talk about you say right off in the beginning that you didn't know Melissa Witt in a traditional sense. Yet your lives are deeply connected and forever intertwined. Tell us about your fascination with true crime or your interest in true crime, O.J. Simpson, and when you first heard about Melissa Witt.
So, you know, really for as long as I can remember, I have just been fascinated with true crime. I mean, it was really an obsession and it really just catapulted for me, you know, as a 21-year-old during the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, that was the first time that really, you know, America had a front seat, so to speak, to a trial like that. You know, they called it the trial of the century. So, you know, during all that, I was, captivated by what was going on. And at the same time, you know, it was all over the news that this girl from Fort Smith, 19-year-old Melissa Witt, had gone missing. You know, she had just disappeared from the bowling alley there in Fort Smith. And so I was really familiar with the case. I'm an Oklahoma native that had moved to Greenwood / Fort Smith, you know, my seventh grade year. And so, you know, as fate would have it, I had a lot of friends that I made during that time before I moved to Northwest Arkansas that ended up being actually pretty close friends with Melissa Witt. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of connection to Melissa, even though we actually never, you know, we never met.
Tell us in our audience what happened on that fateful day, January 13th, 1995.
Well, on January 13th, that was the day that they found Melissa's body, but she actually went missing on December 1st, 1994. It had started as just a normal day, gone to the bowling alley. And, you know, that evening she'd gone to the bowling alley and never made it inside. And so, you know, for 6 weeks, law enforcement and the community really just desperately searched for this 19-year-old girl. Nothing like that had happened in Fort Smith ever before. And, you know, it blew up into this huge story because the community was shocked that something like this could happen. And then on January 13th, it just so happens that I was actually driving to Fort Smith that day for some things that I had to do for my job. And I was listening to the radio, listening to things that were coming on about the O.J. Simpson trial, which is what I was tuned in, you know, to hear. And that's when they made the announcement that a body had been found in the Ozark National Forest. And there was speculation that that could be the body of Melissa Witt.
Now, tell us, as you jump ahead somewhat to 2015, and now you're a documentary producer and filmmaker. Tell us about this project.
That project was really born out of, you know, one, my love for true crime, but also, for almost a decade, I had been a part of a nonprofit that I founded called Let's Bring Them Home. We provided services to families that had missing adults on a national level. It, you know, our services were winding down in the mid-2000s because of the rise of NamUs, a government database that could do the job better than we could, and it was funded by the federal government. And so to kind of finish off and you know, complete what we had been doing through Let's Bring Them Home, that passionate, you know, desire to help families, we committed as a team that we were going to do a documentary. We had originally decided that we were going to focus on missing persons and the epidemic of missing adults in the United States. And really, as our team would sit down looking at cases, people kept bringing up Melissa Witt's name. And I would say, no, we can't do that case.
Right.
We wouldn't follow that case because her body was found. And so what makes that so ironic is I was so against us choosing the Witt case. So the team pretty much talked me into it. I contacted the Fort Smith Police Department and asked if we could meet with them. And really, that's where it began. After that initial meeting with them, I really knew that we had to do something. And we decided to go ahead and choose the Witt case, which again, like I mentioned, it's kind of ironic because, you know, before I was so adamantly against it, and now I'm just a huge advocate, you know, to get Melissa's case solved.
You talk about going to the Fort Smith Police Department for information. Who did you speak to there? Who was the lead detective on that case, and who did you speak to?
When I first contacted the police department, at the time, it was the sitting chief of police, and they've had several since then. And he put me in contact with the detective on Melissa's case at the time, which was Detective Troy Williams. And the department had actually worked with us before because of our nonprofit. So we did have some credibility with them in terms of they knew they could trust us. We'd worked with some, you know, missing persons cases. And so Detective Williams invited me to come up and just sit with him and get to know the case a little bit better. He was new to the case and really wanted to see it solved. And through that, he set up a meeting for us with the retired detectives, JC Ryder and Chris Boyd. And so, you know, I got to meet everybody all at once and actually some other detectives that had worked the case. And I was just blown away at the passion that Ryder and Boyd had for Witt's case, how desperately these men wanted to see this case solved. It was very personal for them.
You essentially interviewed both of these men and had them answer questions that you had. How much information did you have prior to going there in terms of some of the things involving the crime scene? What did you really know about this case? And tell us what each one of these detectives informed you about.
So when I went into this, and I laugh about it, I was such a rookie. You know, most of what I knew was what, you know, we could find through research and old newspaper articles and just things that we had known that had been passed down. And we had done some, you know, cursory interview type things with people in the community before we met with the detective. So I felt like we knew a lot, but little did I know, you know, there's just so much more to the case than what even the public knows. And so my first initial interviews with Boyd and Ryder were pretty in depth. It became very clear that we were going to need to have a series of interviews, but they helped me understand the scope of the case. There was a lot of questions and speculation about, you know, why did it take so long to find Melissa Witt's car? You know, how many suspects are involved in this case? And so they got really in depth with me on some things that I think the public had wanted to know, and it wasn't really ever explained. And then as we built our relationship and they grew to trust me and saw the value in what we had to offer to help assist them with the case, you know, they were able to share more and more and more with me. So, you know, that was a gradual process from the first day we met until, you know, I was sitting in a room looking at the case files. And, you know, that was really just born from these two men really wanted to see the Witt case solved. And this was kind of like that perfect storm of here's some people who can help, you know, they're passionate about this. They're going to put together this documentary. And that's really what happened. And we had some intense meetings there in the beginning because we thought we were going to finish this documentary in 6 to 8 months, which is, it's laughable now looking back.
Right.
You know, that just shows how green I was to this. And what happened through that process is that I started the Facebook page, Who Killed Melissa Witt? And that Facebook page took off like somebody had started a wildfire. I mean, I went from 500 people following the page to 7,000 pretty quickly. And they really began to see the power of social media and how that could impact this case. So, you know, it was a gradual process. And now it's just, you know, we work together pretty closely. I talk to J.C. Ryder almost every day at this point.
Tell us about the horror of what happened that day, December 1st, this innocent. And you talk about innocent, and again, it's understated. But tell us what happened that fateful day at the bowling alley.
You know, from what we can gather, Melissa did go to the bowling alley. And when she arrived, the attack would have been pretty quick. Whoever was there was already waiting on her. We believe they knew she was going to be there. They would have approached her pretty quickly. An argument ensued. And at some point, she was struck in the head. And, you know, from the pools of blood that they found on the pavement, you know, it was pretty clear. You know, they started over by her car, and then the pools of blood went to several feet back to another parking place where the perpetrator had been parked. And he either put her in the trunk or back of the truck or a van and took off with her. You know, the blow would have been brutal, but it was not fatal. There would have been a lot of blood. We believe it probably scared the perpetrator enough to think he could have believed that he had killed her. At that point, I think he panicked. You know, he took her to a familiar place. We believe that he'd been in the Ozark National Forest before. What's scary to me about that is that it's about an hour away. So at some point, she would have regained consciousness and would have been terrified. You know, she's being driven to, you know, this remote mountaintop under the cover of night. And we know from the autopsy report that when they arrived at some point in the Ozark National Forest, very near, if not at the location where her body was found, she was strangled face down as she fought for her life. And I do believe at that point, the killer probably felt like he had no choice but to kill her because of the argument that had ensued and he had already injured her. I don't know that he necessarily had planned to kill her all along. I really don't, because the crime scene was so disorganized. You know, you just don't typically see some of that in some, you know, with a killer that has planned something out. So, you know, it's just horrific. He left her there. He took everything from her. He took her clothes. We believe at some point he had probably raped her. He took her clothes. He took her jewelry. He took everything. And he just left this 19-year-old that had been vibrant and full of life. You know, he took everything from her and he took her life and he left her there and she stayed there for 45 days. It's just horrific. And, you know, I write in the book about being at the crime scene, you know, when the detectives take me out to the remote mountaintop, and it was horrific seeing that and experiencing that. And it changed my life.
Now, to the idea of suspects, you do have a list of people that they went through, that they examined, and then you did your own examination. You went further than the police and with their blessing. Tell us just about some of the promising suspects and leads.
You know, one of the most promising suspects in the case is Larry Swearingen. You know, he was in the area at the time. We can put him a couple hours away. Several years later, he's convicted for the rape and murder of a 19-year-old girl named Melissa Trotter. She's taken from her community college. She's driven an hour away to a national forest where she's strangled and her body's left. I mean, the crime is almost identical. And for years, law enforcement tried to get an interview with him. There was a lot of red tape because it was in Texas. You know, Texas felt like they were going to handle him and execute him for the Trotter case. And so it took years to even get an interview with him. And of course, he never admitted to anything that he did. Larry Swearingen and I had a very, you know, you can't say love hate because there was no love, but the man was not fond of me at all because I was very relentless in my pursuit to get some answers from him. You know, he was executed in August of 2019. There's still a lot of questions. He's still the number one suspect in the Witt case because of the similarities to the crime that he committed in Texas, because we can place him in Arkansas within days of Melissa Witt's murder. There's a lot there, but there's just not enough to charge him. And that's been a frustrating process. So he's viable. You know, there's Travis Crouch, who is in prison in Colorado. And police looked at him really, really hard. You know, he was arrested in Colorado for raping a young girl and taking her to a remote mountaintop, and where he made her strip completely down. And she believed he was going to kill her. Fortunately for her, he passed out from like this drug-induced stupor, and she was able to escape with her life. I have communicated quite a bit with Travis Crouch, and he's not been ruled out in the Witt case, but I think it's just, I think it's just a matter of time before maybe they can formally do that. There's just we can't make any connection to Crouch and Witt. He didn't even have his own vehicle at the time. Any vehicle that he did have access to was searched. He did grow up in Ozark, just a mile and a half down the road from where Melissa's body was found. So there's a lot of circumstantial things that make you stop and say, but as far as being able to place him anywhere near Witt, we just can't. There were hundreds of people that were interviewed. I've gone back to some of the most promising folks and looked at them and talked to them if they're still alive. You know, I have tried to do that. And there are some people that law enforcement are looking at pretty hard who have never been named publicly. And obviously I can't, talk about who they are. I can tell you that, we're all looking at them very closely. And there's been some new developments in the case. And so I'm kind of excited to see where that goes. And as Ryder says, we'll follow it till the very end to find out what we can. And so that's some exciting things, at least for the Witt case. And I'm hopeful that'll put, the book will put some pressure on some of those people who know they're being looked at, but they've not been named publicly.
Part of your strategy was to find, to utilize social media and to put out information, again, strategized with the detectives, Ryder and Chris Boyd often, and to make sure that you were reaching out to people that were interested in this case for information. Tell us about your social media strategy.
So, we wanted to do something a little bit different in the Witt case. What we wanted to do is to memorialize Melissa and help people remember, her life, because she was only a murder victim, that one little bit of time. And so we wanted to start this Facebook page where we were asking questions, but we were also sharing with the community who she was, so we could make her real to the people who, didn't know about the case or were just reading about the case or never knew her. We wanted to make it very personal. And so we did that, and we told the story. And we told the story of what happened to Melissa by asking questions, presenting factual information that law enforcement would allow us to use, things that had already been in the media before. We would put a fresh new spin on it. And we gained a following from that, especially in the Fort Smith community in the beginning, and then it grew. And so at this point, we have, over 13,000 people who like or follow the page, which is exciting. That's really grown. But we've had our posts shared at this point, I was looking at numbers, millions of times over the years. So we're looking at a huge reach that we've had. And I really think that our success has come from working with law enforcement, looking at what information we want to share or put a new spin on or give more information to than was shared back in the 90s when Melissa went missing, to help the community kind of embrace this as like, she was our girl, and it's up to all of us as a community to kind of link arms and say, we're going to get justice for this girl. She deserves it. And that's really kind of the movement. So we started a movement with a hashtag justice for Melissa Witt. And that's been incredibly successful. I'm really hopeful. Social media has brought in, there's no exaggeration here. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of new tips, information law enforcement never had before. It's resulted in interviews. It's resulted in several house raids. It's resulted in really things that have been very impactful for Melissa's case. you know, you can kind of check off some boxes. You know, there's information that the public doesn't have. You know, we know on the back end, and there's just been some things that we've been able to roll out. There's been other things that we've been able to look into further. I mean, it's social media is so valuable, and I hope that other cold cases and advocates and detectives will work together and maybe kind of take what we've done and do something similar, because it will be eventually what solves Melissa's case.
You talk about a conspiracy theory that really stood out because there was more than one person proposed a conspiracy theory to you. One theorist stands out, Sandy Jones. Tell us what she had to say.
Sandy Jones approached our team with, you know, information that she had known Melissa, that they were friends. And it really turned out that that wasn't the case. Sandy, like a lot of us, she was into true crime, has a ton of information about it because she's a lifelong resident of the area. But really, it just kind of turned sinister with her. She really tried to interject herself in the case with information saying, you know, I have information on who killed her. But she did it in some ways that were very malicious. And, you know, it was difficult for our team. We still deal with some of the problems that Sandy has created for the case, because she would set up fake profiles. She would send in fake information. She would contact reporters with, you know, a theory that she had and try to share it as fact. And that's been difficult. It was really shocking to me that that sort of thing could happen in a cold case, because it can be very detrimental, especially to an advocate or to like a documentary team who's trying to make a difference in a case, but then you're being bombarded with false information. And we're really careful, and I hope I made it clear in the book, and I try to make it clear on social media, that we also want to protect the integrity of Melissa's memory. And with Sandy Jones, she's made that difficult because it's almost like she has no care in the world in terms of who she hurts or how that can insult the case or Melissa and her extended family. So it's been a learning process. We do think that we have her contained at this point. You know, we did have to get some, you know, attorneys involved. but I think that's a real problem in cold cases. I really do. I feel like this is pretty common. And, you know, Ryder and I have talked about this at length. You know, they've experienced it in other cases as well, not with Sandy Jones, but with other people. So just for us, she's just really been a thorn in our side for many, many years.
Let's talk about when Detective Williams contacted you from the Fort Smith Police Department and handed you Melissa's diary. You said it was magical and heartbreaking. Tell us what crucial information you gained from this. Tell us about the experience of reading her diary.
I think it was magical. It was like visiting an old friend, really. And it was, you know, it invoked so many emotions, from happiness to disappointment to sadness, because I learned so much about who she was as a person. And to not get to not know her personally, but then to get to read her private thoughts and, you know, how she talks about things that have happened in her life was really something very rare and special. And it was heartbreaking to see just how sweet and naive and innocent she was, because that's what the diary did relay to me, how easily she could have been taken advantage of by someone who comes at her in a parking lot at night, you know, just kind of seeing it that way. I do believe that it's really possible that the killer's name is in that diary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I take that very, very seriously. And I have to be very careful what I say right now in terms of that particular angle. But we really press hard on getting information that we can cross match against what's in that diary. I really think that when this all is said and done and the case is solved, and I do believe that that will happen, that it's all going to come back to a name that she pinned herself in that diary. And so it's critical. So I've read her diary, you know, dozens of times at this point, just because it's so important, because I bet so many of the tips that come through our Facebook page, and we get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds every month. And so it's really important that I know, as Melissa's advocate and how involved I am in the case, what's in the diary. And that helps law enforcement when I turn the tips over to them. So it's just that diary is just a critical piece. One, because it helps my team, me especially, feel like I know Melissa. And I do know her now in a way that a lot of people never will, based on those private thoughts that she shared in that diary. And I also know that she unknowingly had some pretty dangerous people in her life. And that's heartbreaking, really, to know that. So, you know, it was an honor to read her diary. And at the same time, it's something I take very seriously because, like I said, I think it will be critical at some point when we have closure to her case.
Absolutely. Let's stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to the latest research, 90% of employers plan to make enhancing the employee experience a top priority in 2022. After all, a happy workplace is key to attracting and keeping great employees. A few ways employers can make their employees happier is to make them feel more valued, offering them, for example, more learning opportunities and possibly allowing more flexibility in their work schedules. And if you need to add more employees to your team, there's ZipRecruiter. Their matching technology helps you find the right people for your roles fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Find the right employees for your workplace with ZipRecruiter. Try it for free at this exclusive web address, ziprecruiter.com/murder. That's ziprecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we were speaking about the efforts to speak to people that are contacting you via social media. You said that an incredible amount of leads were gained from this effort. But what's interesting is when you talked about one of the main suspects in this, the Swearingen, there was an effort to, and he was agreed to an interview. And so Ryder and Chris Boyd and yourself were set to go to interview him. What happened?
Well, what ended up happening is Ryder Boyd and Detective Marion, who's the new detective on Melissa's case, they went to Texas several months in 2019 before Swearingen was set to be executed. And so they were given the opportunity by the DA's office there in Montgomery County. So Swearingen knew that some people were coming to talk to him, but he didn't know who. So they go to meet with him, and everybody had told the detectives, be prepared. Swearingen likes to talk. He's going to talk your ear off. I think you're going to get all the information you need today. So they go in, they're sitting down, they bring Swearingen in, he sits down, he goes, okay, boys, what are you here for? And they, you know, that's when Detective Boyd said, well, Larry, you know, my name is Chris Boyd and I'm from Fort Smith, Arkansas. And that's when Larry Swearingen said, nope, I'm done. I want to go back to my cell. I'm not going to talk to you. And so that was shocking. And that was it. They didn't get to ask him any questions. He refused, which, you know, we have a lot of people ask us questions, you know, what do you think about that? What did that mean? You know, we're never going to know. They executed him two months later. And so it was really disappointing, but it was just a huge blow to the Witt case because we had waited for years and years and years for that opportunity. And I know that just since I've been involved the past 7 years, I've been very active in doing everything I can to make that interview happen. And then to get nothing out of him and him to recoil at the sight of Fort Smith detectives, it leaves a great big question mark.
What was the response from people that knew Larry to you?
In terms of that interview, they were shocked. People just could almost not believe it because we've had dozens of people. I've personally, you know, interviewed family members, you know, friends. I've had people who've worked on death row that knew Swearingen contact me, and they all say the same thing. You know, he was a narcissistic, big talker that took every opportunity to be the smartest guy in the room, so he thought, and to just talk your ear off. And it was surprising. It's made people take pause. Like, I've actually had people say, that frightens me. Did he kill Melissa Witt? You know, it does leave a question mark. It truly does. But I also know that Larry Swearingen was a very, very smart man. And he just was. And had he talked to investigators and had indicated at all that he'd been in Fort Smith, he very well could have gotten another stay to his execution. So that surprises me a little bit that he didn't even try to take that angle. We just may never know. I mean, it's really confusing and shocking. And the state of Texas feels like he got what was coming to him. I don't know. I can't say one way or the other. You know, he never admitted guilt in the Trotter case for sure. And there's dozens of people in Texas who claim that I helped the state of Texas kill Swearingen. And that's not true. That isn't true, but that's one of the things I do write about in the book. It's just the amount of death threats I have received and some of the angry things that people have said and done to me because I've been so vocal publicly and on a national level about Larry Swearingen.
You talk about looking at a newspaper article, the Southwest Times Record, May 17th, 1995. Police ask help finding Melissa Witt witness. And you went to Detective Williams, and a witness had saw a man and he didn't have any hunting gear. Tell us about pursuing this lead.
So when I came across that newspaper article, I write in the book about how I called Detective Williams and actually dropped everything I was doing that day because I'm about an hour away in Northwest Arkansas and drove to Fort Smith to be able to meet with him. Because a witness saw this man changing clothes very near the place where Melissa's body had been found, that's a critical piece of information. And I wanted to know more about him. Did they find him? Where did they take that lead? And as it turns out, they had released a composite sketch of the guy. It's a poor composite sketch. You know, I talk about that in the book, but they never did actually find the guy. And I'm convinced that we could still potentially find him or name who that is based on the description of his, you know, the color of hair and the type of car that he drove. It was just really unique. And I think that there are no coincidences. I mean, I've been to that place, you know, where they found Melissa's body in the Ozark National Forest, and it is out in the middle of nowhere. And I just can't imagine there would be any reason for somebody to be out there that was not a hunter, that would be changing clothes, that also just so happened to be within feet from where they found Melissa's body.
Right.
I think that's a critical piece of information that could very well at some point tie back to Melissa's diary. And so I have waged a huge campaign over the years to try to find that person and to share that information. And we've had a lot of information come in. It's just not led us to the person. And I will be kicking off some more information that we'll be sharing on Facebook in conjunction with the book, since the book just was launched. And we're going to make another full-scale effort to find the guy. And what we're going to do is similar to what we did at the 27th anniversary. I put up, our team put up 12 billboards all over, you know, the River Valley that had Melissa's photo, you know, who killed Missy Witt? Somebody knows.
Yeah.
Very powerful. We're going to do the same kind of campaign with this composite sketch because we're going to find the guy. Somebody knows who he is. Somebody's going to remember who that was. You know, they're going to learn about that car. It's so unique. They're going to say, oh, I think it could have been this person. And it, you know, all it's going to take is that one name that is given to us that we can track down and can prove that he had that car and it tie back to her diary. I mean, I'm just convinced of it. And so I'm not going to let that angle go.
Another incredible angle that you pursued and considered was from a person named Horror Man emailed you. So tell us about what he said happened.
You know, that whole entire situation was very, and is very frightening, and it's ongoing. But essentially what that boils down to is Horror Man is one of maybe, and I write about this in the book, statistically 100,000 people who are into worldwide who are into something that's called necro porn. And essentially that is, it's not like a snuff film. I mean, it's all pretend, but it's, you know, based around killing these, you know, young women, essentially. And so I did a lot of investigation into that angle and came across this screen name named Horror Man, who wrote about things that were so frightening, I felt like it could be real. And I've seen a lot over the years, so it takes a whole lot to scare me or to make me think there could be some legitimacy to this. And there had been some things that he had written that were so specific that I felt like I needed to alert authorities, and I did. And so, you know, I posed under my own screen name, you know, in some of these forums online, and tried to find Horror Man and put some messages out. And somehow he was able to trace me to my real name and my real email address, which was really disturbing because I had taken a lot of precautions. And he just basically said, you know, here I am. Here I am, LaDonna. You know, you wanted me to come out and play. And so I've had some correspondence with him off and on. It's led to some other very strange things that have happened. And I actually end the book with one of those emails that I received. So that is going to be ongoing. It's real interesting to me to think that we could find somebody who may be connected to, you know, that kind of particular fetish where they fantasize about strangling women and killing them in that fashion, because, you know, that fits with what happened to Melissa. You know, it's something that we're going to continue to pursue. It was difficult for me to write about. I'm going to be honest. I really debated whether I was going to put it in the book or not. One, because it's shocking. There's a lot of shock and awe that goes with it. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to send, you know, my readers on some wild goose chase where they started looking up things on the internet that were dangerous and could be harmful to them, if that makes sense. So I did end up sharing it because I thought it was important, and there will be definitely more to come about that. But it's been definitely the most dangerous, I would feel like, and the craziest angle that we've had, you know, to date in the Witt case, besides, you know, what we call the mysterious Mr. Riley. And I wrote about him as well.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, I know this might be difficult, but you came to this story honestly. You talked about your true crime fascination, and at the time that you heard about Melissa Witt's disappearance and then her body being found, you were in the midst of following the O.J. Simpson case like so many millions of people. But you had your own attempted abduction experience that you describe in great detail. Can you please take us through that? Your own experience.
I can, you know, and that was something that I think, because it was also at a bowling alley and I was, you know, in fourth grade in Southwest Oklahoma, you know, a predator was in the bowling alley that night, and he was slick. He was smooth. He knew what to do in order to continue to engage in a conversation with us, you know, us being myself and my younger sister, but also have enough distance from us that, you know, the adults in the bowling alley weren't suspicious of what he was doing. I mean, he was just, you know, as an adult, as I look back on that situation, he was smooth. He was so smooth. And, you know, essentially he continues to have a conversation with me throughout the night. He really does gain my trust. He tricks me into believing that he knows my dad. You know, and something I write about is how my dad looked up and waved at us and said, hi. And he was talking to me and to my sister, right? The man wasn't sitting close enough to us for my dad to even realize he was talking to us. But after my dad turned back around to go back and, you know, and bowl, the man took that as an opportunity to assure me, see, I told you that your dad would be glad to see me. And I was young and I was naive and I believed him. And so essentially what happened is this man took an opportunity when my dad went to the restroom to try to lure my sister and I out of the bowling alley. And he almost did it. I mean, we were just darn well out that door. And when my dad came out of the bathroom, he saw what was happening. He screamed, stop. And then the man took off and people took off after him. And I write about how that situation really just, it changed my life. I feel like it stole a part of my childhood. It really ripped away my ability to trust. It was something that I've had to work through for years. You know, I was very fortunate that he didn't get me out the door. But, you know, weeks later, we were notified that he had actually hurt another child. And so I was asked to testify against him. And I did that. And after doing so, I really felt empowered, even then as a kid. You know, I was a little kid, but I knew then that life was different, you know, because I learned the hard way about really bad people who were going to lie to you. And I learned about child molestation because my parents had to tell me because of what he had done to another child. And it was very traumatic for me. And for many, many years, I really didn't address that because it was trauma. And you're looking at the late 80s, we didn't know about trauma with children, not the way we do now, and how that can shape you and define your life. And I think that part of what happened with me at that bowling alley, something was triggered in me when I learned about the Melissa Witt case because it was at a bowling alley, right? Not the same kind of circumstances, but just there was just something there. And I think, and I can say from, you know, several years of being able to talk about it and work through it in therapy and kind of understand that that did two things in my life. It did erode my ability to trust people, and it makes it difficult for me to trust people. But it also ignited a fire of advocacy for me. And I'm trying to take that passion that I have and apply it to the Melissa Witt case, because I'm not going to let that man steal anything else from me, because he stole the rest of my childhood. I lived in fear knowing that anybody could try to hurt, you know, a kid. So I do write about it. I make myself pretty vulnerable in that chapter, but I think it's important to share because I want people to understand that that is what's driven me even more to be able to help bring justice for Melissa.
Now you talk about 2017 and my friends at True Crime Garage, Nick Edwards and the captain. You said you reached out to Nick Edwards and they had covered the case of Michael Hilton, the National Forest serial killer. And I had Fred Rosen. He was one of the first people to write about Michael Hilton. So tell us what True Crime Garage and Nick Edwards meant to this case and this book.
Nick has become a dear friend of mine. But what happened is that they had covered that case and I read about it and I saw where Nick had mentioned the Melissa Witt case. And I reached out to Nick because I wanted him to know that Hilton was just not a viable suspect in the Witt disappearance, that he'd been looked at. There just was no connection. And I really just wanted to kind of maybe set the record straight. But in talking to me, you know, the emails back and forth, he asked, you know, can we have a phone call? And so we ended up talking for hours. Nick and I see things through the same lenses in terms of, you know, how we approach like crime scene information or an abduction. And so that made it kind of fascinating. And after talking with me, he invited me to talk about Melissa's case on True Crime Garage. And I had no idea what that would mean for the case. I was not even really that familiar with True Crime Garage at the time. But as it turns out, they were so gracious to allow me to have two episodes to talk about the Witt case. I was a complete rookie at the time. I was just 2 years into this case.
Right.
But it turned what we're doing upside down because it just blew up for us once they aired that case. You know, you've got all these people that listen to True Crime Garage who suddenly are flooding my Facebook page for who killed Melissa Witt. And they're sharing information. They're asking questions. They're, you know, have you looked at this guy? You know, they're liking our page. They're calling the hotline. They're sending in tips. And it just launched us so ahead of the game. It would have taken us years to get to that point. I mean, we grew so quickly overnight and had to adjust on, you know, how are we going to answer this? You know, how are we going to deal with all of these new people that are now interested in the Witt case? And so I've been grateful for that, for Melissa's case. And then through that, Nick and I have become, you know, really good friends. And, you know, he was so gracious that he, you know, he wrote the foreword to the book and I appreciate that. And he's so supportive of our efforts to find justice for Melissa. And, you know, I'm glad for that as well. So, but it was definitely a game changer for the case. And it's allowed us to have other interviews and other people take interest into the case that may have never heard of it before. And so I, you know, hope that other true crime advocates will reach out to people like, you know, Nick or others, you know, like yourself that are doing podcasts that are so important to, you know, these cases, because it really can put a whole new set of eyes on a national level to these cases that desperately need it, because you just never know who's going to have that one piece of information. So I'm grateful for it. And it's just been, it's been fun. And Nick and I are working on quite a few projects together. So I'm excited to see how that's going to further help the case.
Great. You also talk about a meeting, a very important meeting near the end of the book with Detective Chris Boyd. And you talked about very many things like the motive for this, the fantasies that this killer might have had, but also his theory. And he asked you, do you want to know my theory? And you said, yes. Tell us about this conversation.
That day was just so pivotal for me because, you know, not to be, you know, there for there to be a spoiler, but if you look up anything, you're going to see that I have talked extensively about the fact that I believe that Melissa knew her killer.
Right.
And to have Chris Boyd share that same sentiment with me, that he believes that, you know, not only did she know her killer and potentially knew him well, that we think that, he could still be in the area. It was just, oh, I just get chills thinking about it, because I really do think that that's a great possibility in this case. And so that was one of those things that just kind of like it blows your mind as an advocate. But at the same time, you just you start thinking about all the things that you know about the people who were in her life, you know, maybe crimes they've committed since then, because, you know, we've researched those people. Everybody that's in that diary has been looked at very closely. And, you know, you follow what they do over the years, right? And what kind of crimes they might commit or have committed. And it just really, it puts a whole new perspective on the case. And for me, it's just so important because, you know, you go and you can write down Larry Swearingen's name. You can write down Travis Crouch's name. And even though he may look good for it, I just, you know, I have to scratch that off. I just think, no, everything I know about the case tells me, no, it's not Travis. But then you write down some of these other names that you know that are in the diary, that you know knew Melissa, that you know are completely capable. And then you hear Chris Boyd's words echoing in your head. And there's just something about that. I don't know how to explain it. But for me personally, it just drives my desire to try to find answers. And so, you know, there are people that I do talk to that are in that diary. There are people that, you know, that I know that are watching the Facebook page pretty closely, that I know have ordered copies of my book. And so I find that very interesting. It makes me wonder what their interest in the case is, why. It makes me wonder what's going to happen next. You know, is this book going to push somebody over the edge to confess? Is it going to push other people to come forward with information? And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book the way I did. I tried to be very vulnerable and raw with my own personal emotions, how I feel about the case. But really transparent and genuine too, because I want people that are out there that, you know, hopefully they'll read the book and they can feel empowered to come forward and be real and vulnerable and raw and share those emotions and what little bit of information they may have could crack the case. I mean, and there's just, it would only take a small tidbit of information that could turn this case upside down. And so that's the perspective I took with the book, in hopes that I could encourage people to say, I can be brave too. I can tell you, you know, this is what I know. This is how I feel. This is what I think. So I don't know. That day spent with Chris just was, it was pivotal for me. And it was important enough that I felt like I needed to write about it in the book.
Another incredible lead was based around, related to things that were missing from the crime scene, specifically a Mickey Mouse watch with a brown band, you write. Just tell us briefly this lead that you had to look into.
It, you know, the Mickey Mouse watch angle has just, we believe that the killer kept Melissa's watch as a memento. We really do. Law enforcement feels that way. My team feels that way. We've offered a reward for the watch. And I felt like it was important to include that chapter so people could understand the extents that we've gone to, the extent that we've gone to find the watch, because we believe it's out there, but also to see just kind of what kind of crazy we deal with too. Because I specifically talk about the grocery store and somebody approaching me with, you know, some old Mickey Mouse watches. It's critical. I believe, honestly, that the killer still has the watch. And I believe that there's somebody out there that has seen the watch and that has not come forward to call police to say, hey, I need to talk to you. I know this person knew Melissa Witt and I've seen them with an old Mickey Mouse watch. You know, they're keeping it on their shelf or they've got it in a drawer or I see them looking at it sometimes or I came across it hidden under their bed. I really do think that that could also blow the case wide open. And so we're going to continue to offer rewards for the watch. I just felt like it was important to include that angle in the book because one, it's interesting to know that a killer would do that. But I also think that, like I told you before, it would just take that one phone call. And I think it will tie back to a name that's in the diary, really. And so that would just be incredible for the case. So we're hopeful. We're hopeful that something will happen with that.
You talk in the end of the book that a woman calls you about a man's name. Meanwhile, a few days earlier, you were racking your brain and then just compiling a list yourself of names that wouldn't go away. And this woman calls and mentions the same name.
Yeah, it blew my mind because what are the chances that that could happen? And she called me very fearful for her life. You know, this man had been very abusive to her and she had watched, you know, our campaign for justice for Melissa from afar. It felt like she could trust us. And that happens sometimes. People watch it. They feel like they know us and they feel comfortable coming forward. But after talking to her about this person specifically, it became very clear that he's dangerous. He also knew Melissa Witt, which of course piques my interest. And he's hurt other people. And when I say hurt, just, you know, domestic violence situations in a dating situation. And so, you know, it's important that we continue to look at that. And, not to give a whole lot away, but the person that she's talking about has actually been, you know, calling me for years. And so that adds an interesting angle to the case to now know these things about him, know that he has connection to Melissa Witt, know that he's completely capable and could very well fit the profile. And so, you know, it's definitely frightening to have that contact with him, knowing what I know. But it's also critical for the case. And so I'm going to continue to do that. But yeah, I mean, it's some of the things that have happened throughout the course of this case, like that woman calling me, it's just been wild. It's been a wild ride, to say the least. But I do think that it's definitely worth it. I don't have any regrets. And, you know, I'm hopeful that something will happen after the right people read the book.
In closing, you have a letter that's drafted to the killer. What sentiment is expressed? What's the vow in that letter?
That I'm going to find him. When I stood on that remote mountaintop where he left Melissa's lifeless body, I made a vow that I would find him. And I want him to know that I will. I'm not going to stop until we know who he is. And I felt like it was important to end the book with those last few words being specifically for her killer. I want him to know that under no circumstances will I be giving up, that I'm going to continue to make every effort to find him. And I want him to understand how serious that is and what I'm willing to go to in terms of what lengths I'm willing to do to know his name, to see his face. And I felt like that was important to close the book with that. One, because I want other people, like I told you before, you know, to feel empowered, you know, to come forward, but also to see that it's going to take that right piece of information to, you know, to close this cold case. And I want the killer, who I believe could very much still be out there, to know that there are people that still care that this case is solved and we're just not going to stop.
I want to congratulate you on this book and your ongoing investigation, and also mention that the detectives involved in here, Chris Boyd and also J.C. Ryder, also vowed to never let this go as well. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about The Girl I Never Knew, Who Killed Melissa Witt, with my guest, LaDonna Humphrey. Thank you so much, LaDonna, for this interview. You have a great evening. For those people that might want to check this out, is there a website? Is there any other way to take a look at this, contact you, etc.?
Absolutely. I have a website. I actually have two. One is thegirlineverknew.com. There's information about the book, and you can actually contact me through that page. Or you can go to whokilledmissywitt.com. And there's information there about the case, about the book, and you can contact me directly through that website as well.
Thank you so much. The Girl I Never Knew, Who Killed Melissa Witt, LaDonna Humphrey. Thank you so much for this interview. You have a great evening. Good night.